The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Kelly McQuain, and I'm an English professor at Community College of Philadelphia, just up the street. And tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce Edward Hirsch and welcome him back to Philadelphia, where he received his PhD in folklore from the University of Pennsylvania. That right there should tell you he is a man of curious intellect. Folklore? Really? But when you think about it, what better way for a poet to get at the mythos and meanings that make human beings truly tick than by mining what has underpinned world cultures for millennia? Edward Hirsch's roving curiosity is put to good use in A Poet's Glossary, his newest book, a weighty tome that collects every imaginable poetic form, device, movement, and tradition you could hope to come across. Did you know a ganawa is a highly stylized folk poetry song practiced in Bedouin cultures? I sure didn't. Or that the Kaluli people of Papua New Guinea use bird sound words as the prototype that underlies their poetic language. We poetry nerds need to get on Twitter and tweet about that for a while. My favorite entries in this glossary read like mini essays, explaining in a nutshell the whys and hows of poetic forms handed down to us not only by our ancient forebears, but also by more recent innovators. In addition, as the aforementioned examples point out, this glossary is a global one, not limited to the English tradition, but encompassing poetry as a worldwide phenomenon. Edward Hirsch's A Poet's Glossary will go right on my bookshelf alongside M.H. Abrams' Glossary of Literary Terms, and I expect it to prove just as valuable to me and to my students. But a little more about the man behind this monster of a book. In addition to being a scholar and a teacher, Edward Hirsch is also a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. He's received so many awards for his poetry that I imagine his Wikipedia entry can scarcely keep up with all of them, but suffice to say, a snapshot of his accolades include the National Book Critics Circle Award, an NEA Fellowship, and a MacArthur Fellowship. The latter is also known as a Genius Award, so how about that? All this because Edward Hirsch is a man who roams the world in his poems. In his collection, The Living Fire, New and Selected Poems, he took us to the blue-rimmed edge of insomnia. He took us to the snowy Firth of Forth outside Edinburgh, Scotland. He took us back in time to the myths of Hades and Persephone. He took us inside the imaginations of doomed children drawing pictures in the Terezin concentration camps outside of Prague. And he took us to numerous other places as well. And what do we learn if we dare go on these journeys with him? We learn empathy. We learn new ways of seeing. We learn to acknowledge the wonder and beauty of being creatures who can stand apart from the world while being a part of it too. Perhaps in the poem, I Am Going to Start Living Like a Mystic, Edward Hirsch says it best when he concludes, I shall begin scouring the sky for signs as if my whole future were constellated upon it. I will walk home alone with the deep alone, a disciple of shadows in praise of the mysteries. April is National Poetry Month, and there is no better way of celebrating it than being in the company of Professor Hirsch. Tonight, we live not in Philly, but in Poetdelphia, and Edward Hirsch is the man of the hour. Let us give him a warm round of applause as we wait to see what fine things he has in store for us this evening.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be with you. I see you back there. You reminded me of a thing that I was at the University of Chattanooga, and there were two kids. Everyone was in the front. There were two kids sitting in the back. So I went around, said, what are you guys doing here? And they said, well, our teacher said we could get extra credit for coming to the poetry reading. I said, great, but why are you sitting so far in the back? They go, oh, when this guy starts, we're going to sneak out. So ever then, I can't look at the back without feeling the same. I'm really going to thank you for coming. I'm very glad to be with you. Thanks to the Free Library of Philadelphia, which I used to haunt when I lived here. I want to tell you about my book, A Poet's Glossary. I can't say, as they do in a traditional envoy, go little book, because this is a big one. But I thought before I'd start, I'd like to read you my poem to poetry as a kind of talisman. To poetry. Don't desert me just because I stayed up last night watching The Lost Weekend. I know I've spent too much time praising your naked body to strangers and gossiping about lovers you betrayed. I've stalked you in foreign cities and followed your far-flung movements, pretending I could describe you. Forgive me for getting jacked on coffee and obsessing over your features year after jittery year. I'm sorry for handing you a line and typing you on a screen, but don't let me suffer in silence. Does anyone still invoke the muse, string a wooden lyre for Apollo, or try to saddle up Pegasus, winged horse, heavenly god or goddess, indifferent entity, secret code, stored magic, pleasance and half wonder? Hell, I've loved you my entire life without even knowing what you are or how. Please help me to find you. So my book, A Poet's Glossary, which I start with that talisman to say no one knows exactly what poetry is. Poetry is a human fundamental like music. There's never been a culture without it. It precedes prose in all languages and all cultures. And yet there's something ineffable about our understanding of it. Robert Graves called it stored magic, as I quote in my poem. Gavin Douglas in the 16th century called it pleasance and half wonder, definitions that W.B. Yeats especially loved, and so on. I've tried in my book to honor the unconscious and the conscious elements that go into the making of poetry. So my book is a compendium of forms, devices, movements, isms, aesthetics, folklore, rhetorical terms, to try and describe a kind of repertoire of poetic secrets, some of them ancient, which ultimately is meant to suggest a greater pleasure in the text, deeper levels of enchantment. Poetry exists, I believe, in the relationship that's established between a poet, a poem, and a listener, or a poet, a poem, and a reader. Paul Valéry, great French poet, says, the purpose of poetry, please don't be startled by this remark, is not to inspire the poet, that's a private affair, it's to inspire the reader. That's always been striking to me, and I believe it, that the purpose of poetry is to inspire and also to inform the reader. So that's my goal, to give you as a reader a deeper appreciation, a deeper understanding of something that can never entirely be understood. So my book is unusual, I think, because it includes high and low, written and oral, elite and folk forms. I'm trying to bring together the imaginative range of poetic experience from the most rarefied forms to the most popular in folk forms, the poetry of everyday life. And some of the terms are extremely well known, and some of the terms are rare, and very few people in English literature will know about them. I believe that these folk forms and the elite forms are sometimes closer together than one might think. So in terms of, let me try and explain what I'm trying to do in terms of, you'll get it immediately in terms of the forms that you've never heard of. But in the forms that you have heard of, I'm trying to do something a little different than other books have done in the past. So, I mean, I'm trying to give you an example for why I think my book exists rather than just being able to look up all these terms up on the internet. So if you look up on the internet, say, the word sonnet, as an example, or villanelle, or sestina, or any one of them, terms you may have heard or know, forms you might know in some detail, some you might not know, say sonnet, any internet text will tell you that a sonnet is 14 lines long, and there's a Petrarchan form of the sonnet, which is 8 lines and 6 lines, and there's a Shakespearean form of the sonnet. It's just in case you were sleeping in that lesson in high school or can't remember anymore. And the Shakespearean form of the sonnet will be 3 quatrains and a couplet at the end, and one's the Italian sonnet and one's the English sonnet. Any book will give you that information, but that won't tell you why people write sonnets or why they care about them. What I've tried to do is to explain that, to give you that information, but also my theory, which is that the sonnet was invented around 1235 in Sicily by a group of notaries around in the court of Frederick. And these were legal minds, and they constructed a form. No one knows why, by the way, 14 lines works so well. There have been some arguments that it's related to the golden mean, but that's never worked for me because the golden mean is 8 and 5, and I don't think approximation works here. But in any case, these legal minds went to work on creating a form of poetry that was a kind of argument and had argumentation. It probably developed out of the strombetto, which was a folk form of song. Sonetto means little song, if you're interested in this. Forgive me if I get lost in the weeds, because I sometimes do, so you can help bring me out. But anyway, they wrote sonnets not to be sung, but to be read, and they were a very form of elaborate argumentation. But what they hit upon as the subject of these poems, these sonettos, was courtly and erotic love. They hit upon love as their subject matter. And I believe the sonnet became the most inexhaustible form, more inexhaustible than the sestina, which is still alive and was practiced wonderfully by the troubadour poets who invented it. The sonnet has had a very durable life because the consciousness of the argumentation comes up against the inexplicable subject of love and can never be understood. And no matter how many times you argue with your lover, the beloved, you are not somehow able to either convince him or her. And the sonnet, I believe, is a compulsive form, which is why they're sonnet sequences. So my book tries to explain my understanding. It gives you the history of the sonnet. It tells you what the sonnet is in its different incarnations. It tells you that George Meredith created a 16-line version of the form called Modern Love to make it more contemporary. Gerard Manley Hopkins made a curtal sonnet, a shorter version. Milton made it a political form, and so forth and so on. But behind all this is something that I don't think you'll get anywhere else, which is my notion that the form is inexhaustible because it brings together a kind of argumentation, a highly conscious, willful form with a subject that cannot be understood, and that's become ultimately the inexhaustible nature of the sonnet. So that's what I think. No internet definition of the sonnet is going to give you that, and that I felt if I was going to do this, I needed to write a book to explain these things one at a time, because yes, I'm trying to do the same thing for the villanelle, for the guzzle, for the sestina, and for all the traditional forms. But in How to Read a Poem, I wrote a glossary of all the terms that were... Is this okay? Are you with me here? So I'll try not to talk too long, and then I hope you'll have questions for me, which will be if you're not too shy, that would be interesting for me, and we could talk about poetry that way. In How to Read a Poem, I wrote a glossary that was just the forms that and the terms that I'd talked about in that book, and readers began to use those terms, but also to say where are the other terms. And I sort of dutifully thought I should expand this to some of the forms that I haven't included, but it didn't really interest me much. It was just an expansion. But the thing that did interest me and the thing that did make me decide to do a separate book was I realized that I had entirely concentrated on the lyric, which is my form, which I think is one of the deepest forms of poetry, which has been practiced pretty much continuously for 4,500 years, and that I concentrated on that, but I did not concentrate in How to Read a Poem on epics. And I concentrated on written poetry. I didn't really concentrate on oral poetry. Yet I had a PhD in folklore, and I had very much in my mind that there's not only stories and myths and poems and folk songs around the world, there's also the poetry of everyday life. There's the proverb, there's the riddle, there are games like playing the dozens, there's jump rope rhymes. There are all kinds of forms that I think of as poetry. They're on a continuum. And I was interested to notice that no other glossary or combination of literary terms had ever included any of these folk forms as part of what they'd done. No one included work songs or sea shanties. Maybe they included ballads. No one included proverbs or riddles. And yet the linguist Roman Jakobson calls the proverb the smallest coded unit of poetry. Haste makes waste. That is a poetic formulation in itself. So I began to think about this and began to feel that some of the folk forms were not as far apart from the written forms as one might think. Take, for example, the literary form of the epigram, a pointed saying, which probably began in Greece out of written epigraphs that were poems carved in stone, passed by traveler for the one who's died here, or carved into vases. And they began to imitate that and separate it out as a particular form in the Greek anthology. And these epigrams have a kind of power and authority that I've always found very convincing. They're beautiful in the Greek anthology. They've gone on as a program. It reached a kind of culmination in the Renaissance. Pope was a master of them. If you remember Pope's little two-line poem that he wrote for the Prince of Q's dog that he put for the collar, I am His Majesty's dog at Q. Pray tell me, sir, whose dog are you? I mean, there's something really funny about that, odd, because there's a recognition from the dog, supposedly, that you may think that I'm inferior to you, but I notice something about you that you don't seem to know about yourself, that you also belong to someone. Or this one that I wrote down for you, which is included in my entry on epigram. Sir, I admit your general rule that every poet is a fool, but you yourself have served to show it that every fool is not a poet. I like one from J.V. Cunningham, which I had known since I was in college, but what I didn't know until I was researching it was that it was translated from a 17th century poem by a Welsh poet, and it's, life flows to death as rivers to the sea, and life is fresh, and death is salt to me. So the poetic thinking there is really kind of amazing in two lines. Life flows to death, a simile now, as rivers to the sea, fresh water to salt water, and life is fresh, like those rivers, and death is salt to me. Amazing kind of thinking that could only be encapsulated in poetry in two lines. The very last entry I added was I'd been reading the anthropological literature on poetry to try and include everything that anthropologists had written about poetry in different forms, and I discovered the form of the lande, which is practiced by women from Afghanistan. And the reason it's extremely difficult to know about this form is because it's completely oral and it's very dangerous for women to recite these poems, so they haven't been collected very much. And Eliza Griswold went to Afghanistan and collected some of them. And one of them struck me with so much power that it just overwhelmed me. And here it is. When sisters sit together, they always praise their brothers. When brothers come together, they sell their sisters to others. This is a devastating social poem. You immediately recognize it to be true, in a way, with a kind of recognition that comes from a very powerful understanding. You feel the danger of this poem. Equivalent poems I found by Bedouin women, practices in Bedouin poems and various other places and various other African cultures of certain kinds of women's poetry. But that power of that poem was very much like the epigram. It operated like an epigram. It has a rule. It has a certain number of syllables in the first line. It has a certain number of syllables in the second line. It sometimes rhymes. It sometimes doesn't, and so forth. So I found that these folk forms have some of the same elements as traditional forms. So take Yeats's favorite form, the Ottava Rima, a kind of very aristocratic form that he inherited from the Renaissance, a kind of eight-line stanza of great elegance, turns out also to be a form of oral poetry in Italy that people memorize because of its strong rhyme schemes and recited and passed on. So what my book tries to do is to bring all of this together in one house and say, this is the world of poetry. So another example I would give you would be the literary form of the haiku and the overlooked, humble form of the riddle. So the haiku, which you probably know from school, we think of as three lines of five, seven, and five syllables, but in Japan, it's one line that goes down the page. We conventionally break it up in this way. It has certain turns and conventions. I like one. It started as it broke off. There was a five-line form called the tanka, and then in the 17th century, Basho began to write haiku on their own and carried it off and made it a separate form. I like one from Issa, the world of dew is the world of dew, and yet, he says something beautiful about transience. So I felt a kind of liftoff when I hear that poem from Basho, a kind of epiphanic moment, and I realized I was having a parallel experience when I was reading a Persian riddle. Now, a proverb and a riddle are the same thing but inverted, in that a proverb reinforces social wisdom, but a riddle mixes it up. A riddle mixes up cognitive categories. So what I mean by that is that a proverb is something that people use in certain social situations when they want to call on a collective wisdom to authorize their own behavior or to tell someone to do something or not to do something. So you say, I don't want you to do that. Haste makes waste. I'm telling you don't do that, but I'm not just the only one saying that. Because the collective wisdom, the culture understands that we should say haste makes waste. But actually, I want you to do that. Tomorrow, I say to you, he who hesitates is lost. It turns out all the proverbs have oppositions. And they're just all there in the culture, and people remember them because of their coded effects in poetry, and they call on them. The riddle does the opposite. It makes it impossible to put the things together by interfering. And I won't go into all the ways that riddles operate, although I write about it, to interfere with cognitive categories. But I'll tell you one that struck me as undeniably poetry. It's a Persian riddle, and it's a blue napkin full of pears. The sky. And when I heard it, I just felt, I feel the same liftoff that I'm getting from Basho. Or when I read Thomas Nash, and he has that remarkable line, brightness falls from the air. You hear brightness falls from the air, you go, you're in the presence of poetry. You're in the presence of something inexplicable that takes place in language that couldn't be said in any other way. It can't be paraphrased, which is why the New Critics called it the heresy of paraphrase. That is, what you say about it can never be the same thing as the thing itself. Rather than the heresy of paraphrase, I prefer something that the Russian poet Osip Mandelstam said, which is, if a poem can be paraphrased, then the sheets haven't been rumpled, poetry hasn't spent the night. So, you see what I mean. It says the same thing, but in maybe a more powerful and direct way. There's something incalculable in this. So, my idea is to sort of put all this together as a kind of compendium to help people think about the smallest coded devices and the largest subjects. Groups, movements from around the world, but also a series of abstract terms that are hard to wrap our minds around, like taste or sensibility or sentimentality, words that don't mean the same thing to us that they meant historically, or the word nature, which Raymond Williams considers the most difficult word in the English language to wrap your mind around, because these words have complicated histories. And I just thought it'd be interesting and absorbing and powerful to try and bring all this together and think about it from a poet's point of view, not from an academic point of view, not necessarily, I try to be scholarly, but not from a scholarly point of view, but really from a poet's point of view, from someone who's given his life to this and lives inside of it and just wants to know more about it. So that's my book. So thank you. So, feeling brave, questions, thoughts?
I'm wondering if you encountered a form that had some sort of influence on your own poetry during the research of this book, so maybe a foreign form.
If you're asking me, did I start writing in forms that I discovered from, say, Vietnamese poetry or Latin American poetries or Serbian, Croatian, like that? The answer is no, because I spent all my time working on the glossary, and so I didn't have time to do that. But it's in my mind. But I would say that my idea of poetry, of what poetry is, has expanded tremendously. It's changed how I think about poetry. Not so much in terms of like trying, I mean, I'm interested in that, but it's not like I've been like trying Vietnamese forms that I didn't know before. But by studying the idea of the griot, or taking the Yoruba notion of oriki and praise names, and what poetry does and what the poet does in various tribes, or studying the oral formulaic method, which Milman Perry and Albert Lord came up with in the 1930s by studying Serbo-Croatian singers in Yugoslavia and applying that to the Iliad. I'm glad to go on about any of these, but I don't want to terrify you too much. I just expanded tremendously my notion of what poetry could be. And that was helpful to me because I was feeling somewhat restricted by the conventions of American poetry, contemporary poetry, and the sometimes juvenile qualities of it. And so by expanding the range, it put me in touch with something that is just has tremendous different variations and manifestations all around the world.
And by expanding your notion of what poetry is, are you talking about something about more than form?
Yes, I am. That's a very good question. I'm not, yes, there are different forms in different cultures. So, yes, there's the ghazal, which is now coming to American poetry, which we didn't have before. And there are different fragmentations and different forms. I'm not talking about that exactly. I'm talking about the role of the poet or the nature of the movement, whether you're committed to a Baroque sensibility or whether you're committed to the plain style. Whether you're committed to an international aesthetic or whether you're committed to a local aesthetic. The fight about this has played out in culture after culture. Either you're in every culture, there's a T.S. Eliot who says, American poetry needs to belong to European poetry. It needs to be classical. We're part of the world. And then there's a William Carlos Williams who says that American poetry is a local poetry and should write in the vernacular. And this is, plays out around issues of nationalism in every place. And same thing is when poetry becomes too plain or too much like speech, some poets come along like the metaphysical poet or Gangara or Marinism and says, actually, poetry is elaborate. It needs to make the most of the devices of language. It needs to be sonorous. It needs to divorce itself from everyday speech as much as possible. And whenever it flows towards the Baroque, in every culture comes along some Wordsworth who says, actually, poetry should be in the language of the way that people actually speak. And poetry as a kind of corrective moves back in relationship to the way that people actually speak. Or the notion of what a poet does, because the notion of what a poet is in America is not the same thing as what a poet was doing in 17th century Wales, or in Russia in the 1920s, or an Indian epic singer. It's not the same thing of what they were doing in the mountains in Serbia, what their poets were doing, or what griots are doing. Or, I mean, in cultures, for example, where there's no written literature, poets are historians. They remember the tales of the tribe. And in every culture, there is an epic. And the epic will tell you, it's not history. Epics are bad history. But they do tell you a mythical story about how people see themselves and the myths of those cultures, which are crucial. And there's a reason there are singers who specialize in these epics and can sometimes sing them for 6 or 7 days at a time. I mean, what is that? So I think that the, you know, the range of what poetry does is powerful. It's not just we have some poets who like this stuff and then we call it out for births, weddings, and funerals. The role of a poet in different places means something different. And so that's interesting to me, and that's what I'm talking about, not just the forms. I mean, also the forms. But in addition to the forms, the very nature of what constitutes poetry. For example, I discovered something I didn't know about, which was amazing to me, called drum poetry. And what that is, in various, the Native American poets had this before we were here, and it's powerful in African traditions. So Yoruba is a tonal language. There are seven different tones. I can't say no Yoruba, but I've read about it. And so say someone wants you to bring him a coat because you're cold. You can tap on your drum, the so-called talking drums, and in 5 minutes someone will show up with a coat. So that's, I mean, I'm going to make a joke here. That's an instrumental form of communication, but that's not poetry. That's just communicating through the drums. But there is a form of drum poetry which is not practical, which takes that instrumental quality and makes it expressive and makes something you haven't heard before. It won't just tell you to bring a coat. It will tell you what it feels to be in love or what it is to go out hunting or how the dawn strikes me when it comes upon me. But there's no... There's no language, actually. So that's kind of mind-boggling to me. Or I think of a poetry as something that happens in language, as an event in language. But Zen poetry clearly tries to create the poetry of something beyond words, of something inexpressible. It's the very nature of Zen poetry. So all of this is sort of expanding my universe of what I think of as poetry, and trying to get at what I think is involved here, why this always exists in all places. Whenever there are wars, there's poetry. Wherever there's suffering, there's poetry. So wherever there's joy, there's poetry. Wherever there's lament, there's no poetry that I know of that doesn't have a poetry of lamentation or a version of the elegy or keening. Or dirge. I mean, there's a reason that there are these near universals. So, thank you. I'm into it. I hope you are.
I am so into your passion. You're so passionate. And I'm just curious whether you have traveled to certain places in this world that where you've witnessed firsthand some sort of new poetic language that has, as you say, lifted you off?
I mean, yes. I mean, I don't want to, yes and no. Yes, I've gone around to a lot of places, but no, I haven't. I haven't collected tribal poetry. I have gone to festivals where you, if you ask them what kind of a poet, I say, what kind of poet do you think I am? They go, we think you're a page poet. You go, what's that? Well, that's a little group that writes for the page. Some, you know, particular ghetto now. People write for the page. So yes, to some extent. But really, I have to say, it's the majority of it has been through my reading. I mean, I have listened to recordings, but my book tries to be so wide-ranging in terms of this. It's like, what were the poets doing in 17th century Ireland? What were they doing in 1920s Russia? Where would I put myself in? How do I think of what I would be doing if I were in this culture, if I were in Montreal in the 1950s? Would I be saying we should be separatist and write only in French, or would I belong to the international school? I kept finding this personal in an odd way, trying to decide how I'd feel about it and what I'd do, and that's how I sort of transported myself, because it's not all contemporary. So mostly it's been, I have to say, through my reading. But I have gone around to some extent and listened to recordings and been with poets, but mostly it's been through reading about it and reading it.
You used the word lift off a number of times to express the place that these words you were saying placed you, took you. And I'm wondering how that relates to your own writing of poetry. And I guess I'm asking, is it often that something lifts you off in a way that you then go and do whatever you do to make that lift off last and write a poem, and do you know it's finished when you've lifted back off? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because you're seeing, in a way, you're identifying my own maybe poetic inclination, because there are a lot of poems that don't lift off that are very interesting. You'd say light verse doesn't lift off, satirical verse doesn't lift off, certain kind of ironic poetry doesn't lift off, a certain kind of social commentary doesn't lift off. But I have a preference for the epiphanic and for the turn, what the Italians call the volta, where it just, the springboard. So I think that these moments of transcendence or epiphanic moments or ineffable moments, which may be partly what you're talking about, are fleeting. I don't think in any poetry that I know of they seem to last. Even shamans go on shamanic flights, but they don't stay out there. My theory about that is because if you stayed out there, you'd die. That you'd go transported into the other world. You have to come back. So the way this has affected my own writing is that every spiritual problem in poetry is also a technical problem. That is, everything, mystical poets have always dealt with this. You're trying to get to some ineffable state, but you have to do it through the body, through language. How do you get there? And I've been especially interested in the springboards or the turns or the way that poets do it. Maybe it's my defense against the spiritual state to try and understand actually how it operates. And what I've discovered, which has certainly affected my own poetic process and writing, but a lot my reading, is that for spiritual, maybe I'm turning your question too much, but I'll just explain it as I understand it. The turn to these lifts or this moment of illumination, whether it's spiritual or not, has to do with moving from the ordinary or the quotidian world into some other zone or space. And I noticed studying all these poems, how they work, that they always work in this one way. So you take a poem like Elizabeth Bishop's In the Waiting Room, wonderful poem, which I recommend to you from her book Geography 3. It begins in Worcester, Massachusetts. James writes, A Blessing begins in Rochester, Minnesota. Anthony Hex, A Hill begins in Italy, where this sort of thing can occur. I had a vision once. And so what I feel or discover is that in order to move into some other realm, you need to get there through the actual bodily world that we have. And so these poems begin in the bodily world and then find a trigger. Then there are a lot of names for this. Blake calls it a pulsation of an artery, a moment of moments, which is what Virginia Woolf calls it. Wordsworth calls it the spot of time, that are triggers that get you from one plane of existence to another. Does that sort of answer your question? Not exactly, but I'm trying. I'm trying. Thank you.
Your reference to the page poet made me think of contemporary performance poetry and slam poetry and the sort of competitive aspects that are associated with that. And I'm wondering if you could share your thoughts on what you learned about that movement.
That was very interesting to me because I'm not myself very inclined towards slam poetry. But whenever I've read with slam poets, my friends are always going, no one's going, hee-haw for you, man. Okay, okay. Do you have to rub it in? It turns out that slam poetry has just a remarkable history. I find it very conventional now that it's limited to, you know, a certain number of subjects, all related to social consciousness, usually related to racial injustice, and that the poems are rhetorical in a certain way. But it turns out, much to my dismay, that the history of slams and poetry competitions goes back very, very far. And that we may think of poetry as a competition with oneself, but the troubadour poets didn't think of it that way. And there were competitions in Japan and in India and in various courts that go back a very long way that were complicated. So the troubadour poets had competitions in which one poet recited a poem and then another poet recited a poem in the same form. Now, that's a little more complicated formally, but it is a kind of slam poetry. I'm going to like throw down and you're going to throw down back. And I think that what I've discovered is, forgive me for putting it this way, but I think certain kinds of male aggression were moved away from war towards verbal assaults and duels. And then later, women got involved in it too. But that its initial power was in verbal aggression turned into art. And that the slam poetry is one version of that, that from going back a very long way. And I give just a tremendously long history, I think, an example of poetic contests, which it turns out started with the Greeks and just go back. The Scots have one called flyting, which is just, the insults are so unbelievable. They're just really shocking. And that's on a continuum with the African-American kids game of the dozens, which you may know, which I learned about here in Philadelphia when I was here, which is someone says a rhyme insulting you, and then someone rhymes escalating it up, and then someone rhymes back until someone insults someone else's mother. And then someone else insults someone's mother, and then it eventually breaks down because someone wins. Someone breaks you down. I mean, it's rough, but it's not that different than the elite form that Dunbar was practicing of the flyting. I mean, read Dunbar's poem Flyting Against Kennedy. You'll be shocked. You go, we haven't discovered insults at all. So I think there's a continuum in these kinds of aggressive games, and the slam is in that. Now, you can make it more humane by, you know, not having insult each other, but just have a competition. Or you can just make it more humane by just having people recite their poems and you don't have to vote on the numbers or win. But that's the genesis. That's the genesis of it. It's got a long history.
And it's great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to try to bring Paul Valery and the turn of the sonnet into the same question. I think it was Molly Peacock, the poet, who I first heard say one theory that she had about the sonnet, that the turn was kind of like you get just past middle age. And you've been making this argument, but kind of playing around with it. It's like, well, if you're gonna get somewhere, you better do it soon. And I'm thinking about the way that even that form feels like it relates to the body and rhythm and life, you know, the life rhythm. But
that's a ridiculous theory by Molly Peacock about middle age, but the idea of the turn is crucial to the sonnet, that's for sure.
Well,
sorry.
No, I have felt that turn though in my life, and so that's
definitely
I guess my question is really when you think about form and how it relates to the body, and as I'm saying this as someone who loves and writes free verse, I sometimes wonder though if it was rhyme and rhythm and form that has made poetry memorable or recitable, how does it work with free verse, and is it diluting the memorability of poetry and its place with the reader?
I mean, I think I'm not seeing how the sonnet part relates to the second part, but I'll say that the sonnet took oral poetry into the realm of written poetry, into the realm of argumentation, and that does a certain kind of work. It's still rhythmical, but it's not like a folk song. And that writing, I'm going to get to the free verse part of this, the nature of the sonnet does turn, I think she's right on the volta, that the sonnet is a form that turns, and without the turn, it's not exactly a sonnet. Even the French have a term, quatorzaine, which is a 14-line poem that's not a sonnet. And you can have a 16-line poem that is a sonnet or sonnet-like. Poets have called them sonnets because they have the turn. And certainly for the Italian poets, the turn is the crucial thing. It's more crucial than the 14 lines. Dante wrote 18-line sonnets and 22-line sonnets. The turn is the nature of this argumentation. Well, I'd say that poetry is a bodily art, and it always has its origins in breathing, in the pulse, in working, in lovemaking. It's a physical art, and that's related to the oral dimension of poetry, and that there will always be folk songs and metrical writing and a certain kind of music that you're talking about that is bodily. But when the Italian poets, the Sicilians, began to write things down, they also discovered that there were things they could get at in the sonnet that they couldn't get at in the strumbetto because it was more complicated. Just like Sappho, when Sappho writes Eros the bittersweet, and she takes two words, bitter and sweet, that have never been together before. Sweet, bitter is how it would more literally be. And puts it down, it gives you time when you read it to think about that. So when you're listening to a Homeric epic, you don't have time to say to the singer, stop, I want to think about the shield of Achilles. Because that's an incredible description and metaphor. The song is going on, and you're just listening, and it's waving over you. I don't know if you've ever been a poetry reading, and you go, this is bad. Wow, terrific line. I like to stop and think about that. But you can't, because if you do, you lose the rest of the poem. So oral poetry does one thing, and written poetry does another. And when you are reading Sappho, and you go, bittersweet, what does that mean? What does that feeling have that we didn't have before when we just called love bitter or we just called love sweet? We all recognize that. The Portuguese have a term called saudade, which is a kind of bittersweet nostalgia, which we don't have a term for. The Spaniards have duende. We don't have a word for it exactly. So something happens when you can stop and think about it, which gives you the quality of writing. I think free verse originates, well, I think it originated out of the King James Bible and the language of prophecy, and that there are the Psalms and the hymns, which you could call metrical writing, and then there's the Song of the Prophets, which go beyond speech, which need a louder or different language than just metrical writing. And when Christopher Smart wanted to make his own, you know, religious poem, Jubilate Agno, he imitated King James. And when William Blake wanted to make his, you know, Song of Jerusalem, his Epic of Jerusalem, he also imitated King James. And that's what Whitman was doing in Leaves of Grass. He was imitating King James to make an epic. And I think that the kind of speech that Whitman was trying to bring, which is a bodily speech, was a kind of prophetic rhythm that you couldn't just get in folk song. Whitman, by the way, loved Sir Walter Scott and loved ballads. He loved the old lays. But he was trying to get at something different. And I think the kind of improvisatory delight that you get in relationship to speech, that you get in free verse, is something you just can't get in metrical writing. But you're also right, there's a kind of trade-off. And when you have the extremes of free verse, which we have now in contemporary poetry, of extreme fragmentation, which is almost schizophrenic, you entirely lose the quality of, you get in song, of the refrain. And that the refrain, a certain kind of repetition, inspires bliss. It inspires a certain cognitive thing in your brain. I mean, poetry in a way is repetition with a difference. And every time it comes back, the refrain comes back to you, it means something a little different. So refrains are crucial, and if you have all free verse, you don't have refrains, you lose something. But on the other hand, since the 19th century, we've discovered there are elements you can get at that you can't get at in metrical writing. This really started in a way, was made very powerfully evident in France, because the Alexandrine has a kind of hegemonic power over writing in France that's even more powerful than an iambic pentameter. It was really hard to break, which is why Baudelaire wanted to write prose poems, because you couldn't get at certain experiences of the city by writing in this highly metrical way. I mean, it would work for Victor Hugo, but it didn't work for Rimbaud. Now, Rimbaud was also a master of the Alexandrine, but in the little poems in prose and in some of the other, you know, notebook entries, he tried to get at another kind of urban experience, and the Alexandrine just wouldn't work for that. So, yes, the answer is yes, we're getting away from the body at some times. I think poetry will always come back to that. But on the other hand, it also enables you to get at certain kinds of experiences and certain kinds of consciousness that you wouldn't be able to get at otherwise. So, thanks for the question.
Yeah. Have you encountered some poetic forms that are so complicated and so difficult that executing them is form for form's sake, and it's very difficult to achieve what you and I would think of as a poetic moment? I'm thinking of skaldic verse, but there may be other examples.
Skaldic verse is a very good example. The Welsh poets had 24 meters that they memorized. They call them the strict meters and the free meters. And one of the reasons that a certain kind of Celtic poetry came to an end was it left very little room for creativity, because the rules were so strict in terms of the meters, and skaldic poetry is like that. It's so formulaic. It does a certain kind of work, I'd say, but it allows for very little creativity. and that there are certain elaborations of form which are so difficult that they just don't leave any room for creativity. On the other hand, you go, well, at least they had some skills. I mean, you look at them and you go, really, 24 meters? I mean, the Celtic poets, you know, spent the highest forms of them, the Feli, spent 12 years studying in a dark room. They were in rooms where they blocked the window so they wouldn't be distracted. They learned a tremendous amount of material, but the material did not leave room for much creativity. And in a way, those forms partially, well, the way of life changed too, but in a way, those forms were the end of a certain kind of poetry. So yes, I've encountered these, not in contemporary poetry, but yes, historically, I think this is one of the reasons some of the forms died out. But you're right, Skaldic poetry is one of the examples.
You mentioned in one of your early comments that something about the immaturity of American poetry, and I'm wondering if you'd say more about how you see that.
you're pitching it up to me, and I don't want to be reactionary here because I am a contemporary poet and I like contemporary poetry, and I believe in MFA programs. I believe they bring a sort of democracy to poetry that's very helpful. But when you have a small, let me try and phrase this in a certain way. When the audience for poetry in the larger culture is mainly other poets, and other poets are mainly determining the taste, and most of those poets are in MFA programs, then you have a poetry where the taste of your culture in poetry is being determined by 23 and 24-year-olds. And it strikes me that maybe that's not the best idea for a certain mature poetry. Now, I don't mean to speak against these programs, and so I'm sort of walking a line here, but I'm saying that, you know, in America, we don't really prize adults. It's like no one's saying, oh, it's great to be so mature. Everyone's saying it's great to be young. But there is something in poetry, traditionally in the history of poetry, that it had to do with wisdom. The Aztecs had a word, tlamatin, T-L-A-M-A-T-I-N-E, which I include in my glossary, means he who knows, or one who knows. That in a lot of cultures, the poet was one who knows, with a certain kind of accumulated wisdom or knowledge. But you're not going to have that in a culture where what you prize is innovation by 24-year-olds. So that's what I'm saying. It's part of our brashness in American poetry is our continuous energy and our youthfulness and our reinvention of ourselves as part of American culture. But I think there are also some limitations to it, towards always going after the newest thing, the most fragmented thing, the coolest thing, and you lose some of the, you know, possibilities of what poetry can do. And when you read a lot of magazines now and you sort of follow contemporary poetry as close as I do, you just feel the sensibility of a lot of this is just fooling around. And I'm not against playfulness. Robert Frost called poetry play for mortal stakes. But the sensibility of a lot of poetry seems somewhat juvenile to me. And so I'm, you know, studying world poetry. You read the poetry of, say, of Rwanda, you go, maybe we just sound like children here compared to, you know, what people have thought about and what people have gone through and thinking about. So that's all. That's what I'm, it's just kind of, I mean, I teach poetry. I love young poets. I work with them closely. I just don't think that the whole culture should be determined by the taste of people in their early 20s who really don't know much about the history of poetry or what poetry can do or what it has done, who think, you know, anyone born before 1990 is really old. So, you know, I'm continually saying poetry has a long history and it's a rich one, and that we're not just struck by the conventions of what everyone is doing right now. So, okay. So, does that seem sufficient? Or do you want me to blast away more? Anything else?
I would like to thank you for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
But also, even more than the talk, the wonderful body of work you've added to the world, both your own poems and the way you've written about poetry. So here's my question.
You don't have to have a question. I thought that was just outstanding right there. I mean, I just thought that was, I'll give you the 50 I get, you know, promised you later. Anyway, thank you very much.
Given, you're welcome. It's most thoroughly deserved. But given that many of us here, and certainly you, have had a lifelong love affair with poetry, I'm interested, since I've taught, how did that love affair begin for you? Either who or what started this, stimulated?
Well, if you're really curious about this, I can say that I started writing poetry out of emotional desperation when I was in high school, and it didn't have much to do with poetry. It had to do with my own inner state. And I didn't know much about poetry, but I felt better when I wrote it. Girls liked it, so that was definitely an incentive. And they thought it was cool, but I would say that I was a person who was writing. I was not a poet, and I was not on my path towards poetry. When I was a freshman at Grinnell College in Iowa, I had a teacher, super cute, named Carol Parsonen, the first person I'd ever met who spoke in complete sentences. And I started showing her my poems. And Carol did a terrific thing for me. She basically said, over a period of a month or so when I was showing her my poems, you have the passion, the intelligence, and the imagination to write poems, to be a poet. But what you're writing is not poetry. Well, she could have, I think, just praised me, and I would have felt great, but I wouldn't have gotten better. And she certainly could have, you know, set me back a long way by knocking me off and saying this is terrible. I thought everything I wrote was so great. I was happier then, by the way. But she didn't. She said, you haven't tied what you're doing to poetry at all, that you're not trying to make anything. You're expressing your feelings. And that you really, if you are interested in becoming a poet, you should really read poetry, not just so haphazardly. Now, I didn't know anything about poetry, but she started telling me, and I started listening, and when people mentioned poets, I would go and read them. And I will say, if you do that for 40 years, you do learn something. I just never heard of anything. And so I started reading them. And if I can just go a little further in this, I can tell you the night that I think I actually moved from being a person writing lines to the night I started to become a poet. And I was a freshman at Grinnell, and someone had mentioned Gerard Manley Hopkins in class. I'd never heard of him. So I went to the library and got a book by Gerard Manley Hopkins, and that night I read one of the so-called terrible sonnets. And it begins, "I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day. What hours, oh, what black hours we have spent this night. What sights you heart saw, ways you went, and more must in yet longer light's delay. With witness I speak this, for I say hours mean years, mean life, and my lament is cries countless, cries like dead letters sent to dearest him who lives, alas, away." And those lines just completely went through me. I can't even begin to tell you what I felt. Emily Dickinson says, when you read a great poem, you feel as if the top of your head were taken off. I felt that my head was taken off, that Hopkins was describing some desolation that I'd felt in myself that I'd never been able to describe. I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day. What hours, oh, what black hours we have spent this night. What sights you, heart, he's talking to his own heart, saw, ways you went, and more you must, and yet longer light's delay. It's not over yet. With witness I speak this, as if he raises his hand. But where I say years mean life, where I say hours, I mean years. He's allegorizing, mean life. And my lament is cries countless, cries like dead letters sent to dearest him who lives, alas, away. I thought, this desolation that I felt, this loneliness that I felt in Hopkins, didn't make me feel more lonely. It made me feel better because someone had named what I felt. And I started looking at Hopkins' poem and I go, holy shit, this thing is a sonnet. You mean it's not just, he's not just writing his poems out the way I'm writing mine. He's like, this thing actually rhymes. He didn't just write it down. I thought, I want to do that. I want to try and give someone what Hopkins has just given me, some future person. I want to make someone feel the way this has made me feel. And I'm going to try and do it by imitating Gerard Manley Hopkins. Now, that's a mistake. It's not a good idea to imitate Gerard Manley Hopkins. It's not going to work out well for you as a freshman in college in terms of your own poem. But what did work out was I, for the first time, was not thinking about my own feelings. I was trying to think about how to take my feelings and turn them into something. Now, later I learned that the oldest word for poetry in Greece is poesis, which means making. A poet is a maker, and a poem is a made thing. And when I tried to make something, I couldn't have put it this way at the time, but when I got interested in trying to make something, I felt absorbed by the problems, and I actually felt better. And then I began to read in a different way. I began to see, how is Andrew Marvel actually doing this damn thing? How is John Donne doing it? How is George Herbert doing it? How is Keats doing it? I thought, I'm not as good as them, but we are operating, they're making poems, and I'm trying to make poems, and I can try and learn and see what they do. And so I started reading with a kind of compulsive interest to see how they did it, and I really liked it. And so that set me off on my, that set me off on my path, and the more I read, the more I liked it. And the more I thought, well, that's cool, let's see what the poets in Turkey are doing, and let's see what the poets in Latin America are doing. And, you know, I read Cesar Vallejo, and I read Neruda, I read Nazım Hikmet, I read the Eastern Europeans that changed my life, I read Miklos Renati and Attila Yosef, the Hungarians in translation, I read the Polish poets, like that. And I began to say, well, you know, they're doing something different that we haven't done here, let's try and see if we can bring some of this sensibility into American poetry. And I was kind of, you know, I was on my path. So thank you for asking. Thanks, everybody. It's just a joy to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.